Howdy, folks, and welcome to our final podcast episode before we hit midterm exam time. I know, you're just as excited as I am. Can't wait, just kind of holding our breath. Hopefully you're not actually holding your breath. I don't want you to do that. I want you to go into this exam feeling confident. So at this point in the semester or the summer or whatever length of term you're in, go ahead and let me know if you still have some major concerns or questions about the way the exam is structured or the expectations. I want to get back to you as soon as I can to, again, alleviate that holding your breath and turning blue in the face. I don't want anyone to lose too much sleep over this test. Losing a little sleep, I understand. But let's say you're going all night studying. We need to put a pause on that because it's not going to really help you. So reach out if you have those concerns or questions, or if you're just really feeling like you're super uncomfortable and not ready to go into the test. Okay, having now addressed those concerns, let's get to today's material, which is continuing our discussion around connecting probability and the normal curve. And as of this episode, thinking about the first set of kinds of tests we can use to identify whether our outcomes or our results are normal, or perhaps they're more extreme. And we're gonna do this using what is known as a Z-score. But before we go there, let's do a little review. First off, we have populations and we have samples. We can't really study our populations, generally speaking, because it's too many people or too many things to study. So instead, we use samples, we gather information from our samples, and the numbers or the values that we get from our samples are estimates for the true numbers or values in the population, which are known as parameters. Now, the process of getting to understanding what the likely parameters are for our population, it consists of taking samples, and several of them, hopefully, so that as we collect data on our samples, we get what's known as a normal curve or a normal distribution. And that normal distribution is going to have at the center of that perfectly symmetrical hill the mean for our samples, which, if we've done a good job of collecting our samples, getting representative samples, is gonna actually be a really great estimate of our population and the true value in the population. Last time, we did a little example using retirement age and knowing that, let's say, the population average is age 65. So we started with a small sample, and our small sample said, well, the average might be close to 67.2. That's not too far off of our true average. But as we increased our sample size, we found our numbers got closer and closer to our true population mean of 65. When we had a large sample of 50 and we kept increasing it, we'd get closer and closer to the right number for the population, known as the law of large numbers, okay? And the structure of those sample means, those sample averages, got more and more like a true normal distribution, the central limit theorem. These two things together help us to think about effective ways to do research. As our sample means start to look more and more normal, like as we can actually visualize our data and see that perfect hill, we know we are narrowing in on the right value for our population. And we also talked about thinking of that normal hill as outcomes. So visualizing the test scores, for example, most people fall in the middle, somewhere around the average, or within one standard deviation above the average, or one standard deviation below. A standard deviation being the general average distance between our true average in our data set and any one other number in that data set. Okay? What we're going to extend today is that conversation about looking at our data and that normal distribution and understanding the probability of getting a certain outcome. So we're going to continue down the road of thinking about the distribution, our normal curve. I'm going to say normal distribution and normal curve throughout, so know that they refer to the same thing. and standard deviations. If you look back on roughly slide 15, you can see the normal distribution laid out, and we know how much of the outcomes or the area under the hill falls within each amount of standard distributions above or below that mean. So 34.1% you see above the first slice to the right-hand side of the line that's the mean, median, and mode. That means 34.1% of the area under the curve is in that slice. Or if we think about it as outcomes, 34.1% of the outcomes fall within that slice. The same thing for the one slice below the mean, median, and mode. There's 34.1% there too. So in between one standard deviation below and one standard deviation above, we have a total of 68.2% of the outcomes. We add the area of the two sections. This is telling us the vast majority of our outcomes fall in this range, almost 70%. So this is going to be what we consider pretty normal. Anything in this range. If we think about test scores and our average is 70 with a standard deviation of 5, most test scores are going to fall between 65 and 75. So if you visualize it that way and that makes more sense, do it that way. What we're going to be looking for with using a tool like a Z-score is, well, where are we at in terms of the standard deviations? And what does that tell us about the area under the curve, which also tells us how likely our outcome is? Let's start by defining what a Z-score is. A Z-score, as defined on slide 28, it's just a measure of how many standard deviations from the mean a specific value is. So it's a true, like, is it one standard deviation above, two standard deviations above? That's what we're calculating. And to truly calculate a Z-score, the formula is listed on slide 27. A Z-score is the actual score we have minus the mean divided by our standard deviation. Using that formula, I want you to do some calculations related to slide 28. Start with the calculations on the left-hand side. Our mean is 12, our standard deviation is 1. So how many standard deviations away is a value of 10, and how many is 15? To calculate this, take your score, minus the mean, and divide by the standard deviation. So our first value would be 10 minus 12 divided by 1. Gives us negative 2. So 10 is 2 standard deviations below our average of 12. Now work that with the 15. 15 minus 12 is 3, divided by 1 is 3. I've made these calculations pretty easy for this first set. So 15 is 3 standard deviations above our average of 12. Let's go with some less well-rounded numbers. And now I want you to do the calculations on the right-hand side and send me what you get. Start out with a mean of 24.2 and our standard deviation of 1.5. Structure your calculations just the way the formula says. Begin with a value, subtract the mean, and divide by the standard deviation. We're not doing crazy math here, but I want you to do these calculations on your own and send me what you get. And hopefully what you get is exactly what you would expect to get. And I can confirm that for you via email. Now we can, of course, do these calculations, but we can also visualize what the Z-score actually is. And that's pictured on slide 29. Again, a Z-score, how many standard deviations a data point is from its mean. A Z-score of negative 1, as it shows with the purple arrow and purple line, is 1 standard deviation below the mean. That's why it's got a negative value on it. Any Z-score with a negative number is below the mean, or on the left side of our normal curve. Any Z-score that has a positive value, like a Z-score of 2, is going to be above the mean, or on the right side of that normal curve, that hill. And you can see in the pink, a Z-score of 2 is 2 standard deviations above. The Z-score values are listed beneath the normal curve there. So if we have a nice neat line with the ones and the twos and the threes, and you can simply point to that, it's pretty easy to just, again, draw the line and figure out where is that Z-score. And when I say where is that Z-score, I mean where does that Z-score hit that normal curve? Both the pink and purple line draw from a point on the normal curve down to that bottom axis where we have our Z-score values. We're going to be thinking about the value, and by value, I mean some value in our data set, and using that value to figure out a Z-score, okay? So when I'm using the words, if I get the terminology turned around, I'm going to try and catch myself, but the value is the data value in our data set. And the Z-score is telling us how many standard deviations away from the mean that data value is. Now, we use Z-scores to figure out how far away something is from the mean, which if we now take this to probability, we're thinking about how far away something is from the mean, meaning how unlikely it is. Things that are close to the mean are close to average are pretty common or very likely. But if something's really, really far off of an average, we wouldn't think that it's normal. We would think that's pretty rare. So an example, in my family, most of the women are somewhere around 5'4". And my aunt is like 6'2". That is not normal in our family. She would be several standard deviations away from the mean, above the mean. And that would be rare or unlikely. So this is how we're going to start thinking about all of this. How rare something is or how unlikely it is based on how many standard deviations it is away from the mean. And I've repeated on slide 31 that same picture from earlier before. You see, as we get to more extreme standard deviations, going from -1 to -2 to -3, it's less and less likely we're going to be that extremely different from the average. In test scores, this is extremely below the average. Or we could look on the right-hand side. At 3 standard deviations above, this is extremely rare. It would be odd to be this high above the average. And usually, the thing that we do with that is we say, something else is going on here. It isn't just due to chance. Something has affected this. All right, I'm getting a little ahead of myself with that statement. But in order for you to successfully navigate all of the questions on the midterm, we're going to need to be able to understand what a Z-score means, right? How many standard deviations it is away from a mean, and how that connects back to, again, probability. So some Z-scores are a little bit off in terms of the values, like they're not this perfectly rounded number of 1 or 2, but they cover the area of a curve very neatly. So this is slide 32. Between -1.28 standard deviations below and 1.28 standard deviations above is 80% of what we would have for our outcomes, or let's say our test scores. So it's going to fall between 1.28 below and 1.28 above, and that's 80% of the area of our curve. Some more common ones, well, not common in the sense of the term, the value being a rounded number, but 1.64 below or -1.64 up to 1.64 above, 90% of the area in the curve is going to fall between those two. 95% falls between -1.96 and 1.96 for the Z-score. And then 99% of the entire area under that curve of all of our outcomes are going to fall between -2.58 standard deviations below and 2.58 standard deviations above. That's all that this visual is telling you. So if you have a Z-score below -2.58, that is so rare, you have basically a 1% chance of that being the case. One of the difficulties with Z-scores is they often aren't these numbers, right? I don't get a Z-score of exactly negative 1.28 or 1.28. And when I don't get those numbers, but I still want to find out the chances of getting that specific Z-score or something below or above that specific Z-score, well, now I have to do some research, some looking up in my textbook. And in your textbook, at Appendix B, which is in the back of your book, this is where we start to see what is known as our Z-score table, right? So where you should be looking, I believe, starts at around page 150 or page 151. And if you have the physical copy of the book, you'll notice that the table continues on the next page. You basically flip the page over, and that's the table continuing to go down. The electronic version is, I believe, a little easier to view and follow because you can see how the table continues across pages without the page divide. In looking at this table, table B1, which says areas beneath the normal curve, you're going to notice that the columns repeat themselves. It says Z-score and area between the mean and the Z-score, and it repeats that multiple times because it's basically just going from Z-score 0 through 0.49 in the first column and then starting at 0.5 in the next column that says Z-score. So you read it top to bottom and then you move to the right to get to Z-scores that are above where you would see the value at the bottom of the table. A little confusing, but I want you to just kind of notice that the two columns repeat themselves. And if we just did this as a table with the two columns, it would be very long. So instead of doing it very long, they basically go through 0 to 0.49 for Z-scores, and then they move to the right to start with 0.5 to 0.99. And then again, we move to the right starting at a Z-score of 1. You can always start with a Z-score. And that Z-score is the value you see. It's in the column right there. The column next to it, the area between the mean and the Z-score, is literally how much space between the mean, the middle of our normal curve, and that Z-score. So at a Z-score of 0.5, the area between the mean and the Z-score is 19.15. 19.15% of the curve falls between the mean and that Z-score of 0.5. I'm hoping this kind of makes sense as you read through it, but we're going to do some practice with this, right? I want us to think about, first of all, a Z-score of positive 1.5, which is 1.5 standard deviations from the mean, okay? If you find that, you're looking again, probably at the top of the page. Go to Z-score of 1.5 and look to the right of it, and that tells you 43.42. So 43.42% of the curve is between the mean and a Z-score of 1.5. And that's what you see pictured on slide 35, okay? Zero being where the mean is located, that blue shaded region up to 1.5, that blue region is 43.42%. percent of the total area. Or if I had to say that another way, 43.42% of the outcomes fall between 0 and a Z-score of 1.5. Now, this is helpful for us because what we can say is any Z-score below 1.5, well, we know that up to 0, 43.42% of the actual outcomes fall below that, which means we're dealing with a pretty rare outcome when we're at 1.5. But it doesn't totally help us because we still need to think about the rest of the normal curve. If I'm asking you a question to think about how much is a Z-score of 1.5 in terms of the total area under the normal curve, well, we need to extend past the mean, right? We're going to add the other half of the normal curve. Right? If I have 50% on one side, and we know this because we have symmetrical sides to our normal curve, I'm going to take that 50%, I'm going to add my 43.42%, which tells me 93.42% of the curve is below a z-score of 1.5. This is important because, well, not because I just can calculate the numbers and look up the values, but if you get a z-score for a value in the data that's 1.5, you know 93.42% of the values fall below that. This is going to be a rare value. It's only going to happen 6.58% of the time. How did I get to 6.58? Well, it's 100%, the full area under the curve, minus 93.42. Anything that is a z-score of 1.5 or greater is only going to happen 6.58% of the time. It's rare. If we think about this as a test score, your chances of scoring 1.5 standard deviations above, pretty unlikely. And if you do, that's good. You've overperformed. I will say this particular activity is one of the more difficult ones, and it's where people get a little tripped up. So thinking about probabilities and z-scores, what I'm going to ask you, let's say on the exam, is to figure out the area below a z-score and an area above a z-score, which means you're going to figure out all the area under the normal curve below that z-score value, or all the area under the curve above that z-score value. So let's do some practice. I want you to start with z-score of 0.9. What percentage of the area falls below a z-score of 0.9? Or another way I could ask that, what percentage of the outcomes fall below a z-score of 0.9? What percentage of outcomes fall above that z-score of 0.9? Do the same thing with 3.5. These are the practice values I've listed on slide 38. And then try to figure out how you would calculate this for negative 2. Because we're going to be working a little bit in reverse with the value of negative 2. I would encourage you as you do this to draw out the visuals. Sometimes drawing the curve with the z-scores appropriately located helps you to figure out just how much area aligns with each section. And then send those values to me so I can let you know, all right, this looks correct or not correct. And when you're having struggles thinking about each one, go back to the visuals that range between slides 35 and 37 and see if that helps you kind of put together what we're looking for there. Okay, now that you've done all that, now that we've done all these calculations, why in the heck did we do all of that? Why do we care about z-scores? Well, the simple fact is using something like a z-score can tell us, again, if something is likely or normal. This is going to relate back heavily to your research questions. Is what we're seeing here normal or maybe even due to chance? And that's a lot of the way it's phrased. If the outcomes fall pretty close to an average, well, it might just be due to chance that we get the result that we got. But if we're testing our hypothesis and we're saying, wow, does studying really affect exam scores? And someone who studies a lot has a z-score of 3, as in 3 standard deviations above the average, we're going to think to ourselves, that probably isn't due to chance. It probably wasn't dumb luck. It's probably because they actually studied a lot. And that is what's having an effect. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is really the value of doing this kind of comparison. And this is what our statistical tests will do for the remainder of the semester. They will simply be looking, is this normal? Is this maybe what we'd expect due to chance? Or is something else going on? Is something else affecting our outcome or our dependent variable of interest? I've captured it mostly on slide 41. When something is really unlikely, we don't think it happens randomly. We think there's something else going on, maybe because of the variable we're interested in. I'll relate it back to the research question I've used as an example for myself in the past. Does programming change the rate at which inmates return to prison? If I got a big z-score, like a positive 2, a positive 3, saying they don't return to prison nearly as much, their rates are much lower, then I'm going to suspect that programming has an effect. But if their rates are very similar, or if their return to prison looks pretty normal, well, then programming probably doesn't have effect. Having classes may not make them less likely to go back to prison. This is really what we're getting at. And the direct quote from the book, a lot like what I've said before. The name of the statistics game is being able to estimate the probability of an outcome. And our research hypothesis presents a statement of an expected event. What do we think is likely to happen? We collect data and use our statistical tools to evaluate how likely that event is. This, in a nutshell, is everything we're going to do for the remainder of the semester, and we're going to apply it to your research questions. And with that, we are done with the material on probability, the normal curve, and z-scores, and pretty much everything we need to cover through the midterm exam. I did have some discussion of the midterm exam before our episodes on probability, going back to the research process, but I do want to re-emphasize some highlights about that midterm exam. And then I wanted to throw out kind of a sample question. It's not a question that's actually on the test, but it gives you a sense of the kinds of questions I'm likely to ask you. So in terms of the structure of the midterm exam, we have two parts. It's divided in two halves, kind of like our perfectly symmetrical normal curve. Wow, couldn't help myself. Sorry, that was definitely dad joke level of stats joke. So promise not to do that again. Two halves of the exam. For this class, you must take the parts of the exam by Friday, October 10th. I believe it's listed incorrectly in the slides. I'm going to correct that. But if you've already seen the slides, it's Friday, October 10th. You're able to get into each part of the exam as of Monday, October 6th. Both sections are timed. You have an hour and 15 minutes, not 45 minutes. Goodness, my slides are so incorrect on this, so I apologize. I'm going to get those corrected right now. Each section, an hour and 15 minutes. Part one is measures of central tendency and variation. That's one portion of it. And the other portion is data visualization and graphing. So thinking of things like the normal curve. And part two, the second half, has sections on correlation, including some questions about reliability and probability. So two halves, two sections on each half of the exam, and in each section, there are two questions, but you only answer one question per section. Let me say that again. In the section on measures of central tendency and variation, there will be two questions. You answer one of them, not both. There are no SPSS sections on the exam. There are some visualizations of SPSS results, at least in the graphing component, so you might have to explain something related to that, but you will do nothing in SPSS for this test. You do not have to worry about that. You can bring in with you one page of notes. I don't care if you do the page front and back, however you want to set it up, but I want you to send me a copy of those notes. And I want you to send that via email after you finish the exam. You can do separate notes for each part of the exam. So for the first half, you can have notes on central tendency and variation and graphing. And then for the second half of the exam, you can have notes on correlation and probability. I would, in fact, encourage that if notes are very helpful for you. Do not, I repeat, do not use any resources outside of the notes. I need to know what you know about this material, and the point of a test is to actually assess your mastery of the material. It's not an assessment of you as a human being or your study techniques or really anything other than, do you know the material well enough to say you've mastered it? And if I say that you have, and that's based on something like ChatGPT, it's really not doing you any justice. You don't actually know it. And we don't have any evidence that you don't because you relied on an outside system. I do use tools like Turnitin to identify any plagiarism. But what we're doing here, I really want you to, again, rely on your own knowledge. The value of a test at this level in college is really to find out what you know. So please make this your responses, your answers. If you submit exam responses that I think are problematic, I am going to contact you and request a conference so that you can talk me through your understanding. Because again, the point is to know what do you know? Not what does ChatGPT or some other AI system know? And that's really where I'm going to leave things for now. Other than to, again, provide one example question. This is from a past version of this course. So this question, I don't want you to take it as necessarily the same structure as the questions I will ask you. It's somewhat similar because I tend to write exams that focus on the same major concepts. That's usually what I do with exams, even in statistics, conceptual stuff. So in this course, when I did exams before, we actually did them online and students had a week to write up their responses, which meant that the questions had more parts to them. So again, knowing all of that, here's the example question from a midterm exam in the spring of 2025. Statistics is formally defined as the tools and techniques that are used for describing, organizing, and interpreting information or data. But as we have learned in this course, most of statistics is focused on samples and sample data, and not on populations or population data. Explain the difference between these groups, sample versus population. Identify the important terms related specifically to measures of each group, and then explain why we use samples rather than populations. In addition, explain why it is important to get a representative sample when doing our statistical analyses. Be sure to define all important and relevant terms in your response. Yes, that entire thing was the question. So that would be the structure of questions if I were having you do an online exam. I want you to think there's going to be smaller bits and pieces, but it's going to be similarly structured in perhaps a short essay style. So if you know that going in, I hope that that helps to clarify what you'll be looking at in each section. Remember, each section has two questions, one answer only per section. So basically on each half of the exam, you write up two responses, total of four responses on the entire midterm. All right, I think that's enough for me today. I want to thank you again for tuning in and listening to this podcast. If and when you have questions, you know how to reach me. I'm always available by email. I wish you the best of luck on the midterm, and I will speak with you again, hopefully very soon.